This is Shine On, the Health and Happiness Show, with new episodes every week on how to live well. Shine On is heard all over the world as a podcast, but it's heard first on the radio in New York's Hudson Valley. Hi, it's Casey. Thank you so much for tuning in to Shine On today. We are going to take a deep dive into your belly. We're going to talk about metabolism repair for women with Lara Bryden, Canadian, now in New Zealand, a naturopathic doctor who has written a ton of books. This latest book is about the roadblocks to metabolic function. What's going on in our cells? What's going on in our bellies? We're going to get a little bit nerdy and scientific. Just let it wash over you. If you don't understand it all, stick with us for the part about food noise. If you have like a fine relationship with food, I would like to meet you. Because most of the people I know, we fret over what we eat. We fret over how often we eat. As we eat something, we're saying, I shouldn't be eating this. There's so much food noise in our brain. I'm not sure any of that is healthy. We're going to learn about the force of the mitochondria and how it's different for everybody. We all have to find our way. In the past, I've been diagnosed with prediabetes, leaky gut, all the things. So for me, it's a constant journey to keep the gut healthy and the mind quiet. Let's just jump right into the science of things when we talk about metabolism repair for women with Lara Bryden.
So insulin resistance is the hormonal condition of the body having a reduced sensitivity to the hormone insulin and chronically elevated levels of the hormone insulin, and then all the downstream negative effects from that, including inflammation, including potentially weight gain from that. Prediabetes comes into the conversation when glucose finally starts to go out of range a little bit and finally starts to become elevated. But a lot of the scientists looking at insulin resistance make the case, and I would agree, that the whole conversation has been for too long to glucose-centric. It's really, by the time glucose starts to go out of range, this hormonal condition has been happening for a long time, usually decades. And so the point of my book and a lot of, you know, growing awareness out there is to shift the focus from just focusing only on glucose and look at other markers of insulin resistance, including it is possible in some cases to measure the hormone insulin. That's not always an easy test to access. So in the book, I talk about all the other ways to look for that situation. And then importantly, with insulin resistance, or also called metabolic syndrome, glucose can be normal, or it can even be low at times, because one of the symptoms of insulin resistance is something called reactive hypoglycemia, which is a tendency to low blood sugar. So that's quite important, because a lot of my patients would say, well, I must not have insulin resistance, because they think of it as being synonymous with prediabetes, and they think, well, my blood sugar's normal, so I must be fine. But that's not accurate. So that's what I'm trying to, one of the things I'm trying to correct.
Put me right now on the straight and narrow in terms of diet. Is most of this controlled by diet?
Diet is important, but also another point in my book is diet and exercise are not the whole story. So I think I'm trying to also push back on this narrative that if you could just get the right, you know, diet and exercise regimen, then everything would be fine. You know, and this is what people are always looking for, the next best. What is the right diet and exercise combination? If I just do that, everything will be fine. But it's, my book is a troubleshooting manual about what I call metabolic obstacles, all the potential reasons that could be in that individual promoting insulin resistance. But in answer to your question, diet is important. And there's no one size fits all diet, but I'll give a few broad strokes. There does need to be sheltering from the modern food environment. So I phrased it that way, sheltering, because we're just bombarded by it. Like the food environment that we're surrounded by, the food that's in all the shops that a lot of us grew up with, that's just everywhere, like it's in restaurants, is not friendly to metabolic health. And the scientists know this because we've had a dramatic shift in the last about three generations. It started around the 70s or 80s, maybe a little before that. Before that, people just didn't have to think about, they didn't have to micromanage their weight. Most people, like, it was just not a thing. Like this now epidemic of insulin resistance was really not a thing, or at least it wasn't a thing in young people. Now it is. Like now we're seeing teenagers and when people in their 20s with insulin resistance. And so the scientists know that collectively we've all been bombarded by something bad. And some of it's probably environmental toxins. Some of it could be medications, which is kind of intriguing. But a large part of it, most scientists agree, is it's the food environment. So then the question is, well, which part of the food environment? You know, some of it's sugar, arguably some of it's something called linoleic acid, which is the main fatty acid in vegetable oils, which is controversial. That's, if anyone's listening, they might have heard some of the seed oil controversy. There is, I think, some growing science around, you know, the fact that possibly this massive dramatic shift from what we used to have was saturated fat up until like the 50s or 60s. And then this like massive shift to like mostly polyunsaturated fatty acids, specifically linoleic acid, seems to be doing something quite troubling at the cellular level. So the main goal is to shelter from what's out there because that's not working. But to do that, we have to make sure we're fully nourished and fully satisfied with something, because you can't just stop eating and, you know, without having something instead. So starting with, for example, protein is very important. All the experts agree on that. Like if you can get a good quality protein, especially earlier in the day, and really with every meal, that can go a long way towards promoting satiety, or that feeling like you've had enough food, you've had enough energy, and also obviously just whole foods. So there's like a lot to be said for choosing, even for example, just choosing whole starches, like, you know, sweet potato, even potato, over ultra refined flour products. The science on that is pretty clear.
I eat a potato every day.
That's good.
I bring a baked potato to work. And like today, I threw on some kale and some cauliflower, but usually it's nuts and seeds, because there's so, you feel good when you eat a potato. You feel full.
That's true.
And it's like real food. Right?
For some people in a situation of, if they're in a more severe insulin resistant state, they may require a lower carbohydrate diet. So that is definitely, it's hard to have this conversation without just acknowledging that's something.
When we look at like Americans or any humans on the planet, really, but Americans specifically, I always refer to, because this is so easy to find, pictures of the Woodstock Festival, because those kids were half naked and having a great time. Yeah. Some of them were having a great time, and they were so thin.
I know.
They were literally thousands of young Americans in these pictures, and they are all thin. But I want to go back to the linoleic acid.
And this is probably one of the more controversial parts of this conversation. So I'll just say that the prevailing narrative is that it's better to avoid saturated fats, like from animal products, and instead have vegetable oils, such as from corn or soybean. Those are the two big vegetables that are most common in the diet, especially in the United States, I believe. They have a high content of a specific polyunsaturated fat called linoleic acid or omega-6 fatty acid. And so this is the narrative for about the last 60 or 70 years has been, that's good. That's good. But there is a growing chorus of scientists who are kind of saying, is it good? You know, is it? Because that's actually one of the things that most dramatically changed right around the time this problem really started at the population level. It is controversial. I mean, there are still scientists today, like prominent ones, who will say, oh no, linoleic acid is good. So, because my background is as a biologist before I became a naturopathic doctor, so I do tend to see everything through that lens. I sort of read the papers and look at what this particular, you know, supposedly healthy polyunsaturated fatty acid is doing in the cells. It's doing weird things to the, what are called the mitochondria, like the engines of energy in the cells. And also just through the lens of, we never used to eat that, right? Like this is something called, a concept called evolutionary mismatch. I mean, we've been human for about 200,000 years, probably maybe 300,000, depending on how you calculate it. We've been Homo sapiens. And through most of that time, we've mostly eaten saturated fat. We would have had polyunsaturated fat coming in from, like plants and seeds and fish and some, but the majority of our diet was saturated fat. So to think that that was, you know, for 300,000 years, that was somehow that was bad, just doesn't make any sense to me as a biologist.
We're talking to Laura Bryden, and Metabolism Repair for Women is her book. And I just have to ask this question. What kind of oil do you use?
Yeah, no, that's totally fair. Butter and extra virgin olive oil, because all the experts agree that extra virgin olive oil is good. It's got, its main fatty acid is something called oleic acid, which is a monounsaturated fatty acid, which is, seems to just be in everyone's, through everyone's lens, that seems to be a good one. I also would have coconut oil.
Talk to me about the mitochondria.
Yeah. Okay, good question. Yeah. So most people would have learned about them in high school biology. They're like, all right, they're the organelle that turns food into energy. But they are really important because it's sort of at that level where, again, the scientists think this might be where the problem of insulin resistance is starting to a large extent. The mitochondria are becoming stressed out about different things, possibly, for example, about the linoleic acid. We know that mitochondria don't do well with a lot of that. But even just an overload of sugar or like a lot of calories or various environmental toxins seem to just, they kind of go into freeze mode and they, stop functioning as well. And if they stop functioning well, then they stop being able to, for example, burn fat for energy, which is obviously something we want to be able to do on an ongoing basis, is, tap into our body fat stores for, good sustainable energy. And with insulin resistance, that is not happening. That's called metabolic inflexibility. But that just means the mitochondria being kind of trapped into carb burning, not as able to fat burn. So there's a lot going on with mitochondria. Fun fact about mitochondria, actually, they're so intriguing from a biology perspective that they were I've fact-checked this a couple of times, they were the inspiration for the Force in Star Wars. George Lucas, apparently, it's hard to get the exact, fact-checking on that information, but I've checked a few sources. And so they make 90%, maybe 95% of our energy, and they all talk to each other, and they're very intriguing. And
Wow. Lovely.
yeah.
What's the nicest thing I can do for my mitochondria today?
They're sensitive to everything. There was just some new research in 2024 finding that mitochondria respond positively to positive life experiences. So spending time with loved ones, or going to a beautiful location,
Wow.
dancing or doing something fun sends them signals that life is good. They tend to kind of ramp up their activity with that, which is fascinating. They're affected by all hormones, including thyroid hormone and estrogen, and they respond to all of that. They respond to what's happening in the gut. So if the gut microbiome, your listeners might have heard about the microbiome, all the bacteria in the gut, if they're sending out inflammatory signals to the rest of the body, the mitochondria respond to that and potentially downregulate in response to that. And then, of course, they respond to movement and exercise because muscle is absolutely packed with mitochondria. So it's a really easy technique that most people you'll hear about in most sources is if you want to, boost your mitochondria, build some muscle. So that's kind of a nice strategy. And also just, again, just to repeat, I think I said at the beginning, but shelter from some of the modern food supply, which is among all the other bad things it's doing, it's definitely potentially harming mitochondria.
It doesn't seem fair to me. If your microbiome is
Yes.
bad and,
Yeah.
leaky gut or all that stuff,
Yeah.
it's
Yeah.
unfair that if you already have that, then your mitochondria downgrades, it's slow or dampen. It doesn't seem fair. You should get both.
It doesn't seem right that you should get both. Exactly. Actually, I'll just take it because I'm a naturopathic doctor, and anybody who, as you say, a lot of people maybe haven't heard of naturopathic doctors, but for anybody who has, they know we're a little obsessed with the gut. So the gut health affects everything through our world. And so there are 10 patient stories in my new book, in the metabolism book, and two of them are about fixing the gut to fix metabolism. So the good thing about it, as you say, the bad thing is it seems unfair. You've already got this problem of leaky gut or intestinal permeability and all the gut symptoms that go along with that. And then you also potentially get worsened insulin resistance from that. But the good thing about that relationship is you can then fix, but you can, by fixing the gut, you can improve metabolic health. And I've seen that in one of the patient stories. We fixed her gut by, a combination, I think it was like changed her diet and gave her some herbal medicine for gut health. And then, within a few weeks, her sugar cravings reduced. They just kind of, in her case, they just went away. And she had been trying to avoid sugar. In her case, she like knew it was bad, and she was like doing all these things to try to, not have sugar cravings in the afternoon. And then it turns out we fixed her gut, and just she didn't have to like think about it anymore. That symptom that was had been a symptom. The sugar cravings in her case had been a symptom, arguably, of the gut problem.
So I have a close friend who's on the Ozempic,
Yes.
and she said it's the only thing that's ever stopped her sugar cravings.
For sure.
Why?
Yeah. Well, so that medication, that's the semaglutide, these GLP-1 agonists are super interesting from a scientific perspective because they do tell us how involved the brain also is in all of this. I mean, those medications, they have different effects. They slow stomach emptying, but the main thing they're doing is sending this satiety signal to the brain. They're also interacting with the what's called the reward system, which is sort of the part of the brain involved in really like addictive type behaviors. So there's a, you know, sort of growing body of knowledge around this, around the quite common problem of food addiction. I know the term food addiction is sort of stigmatizing. It shouldn't be, because like it's just a health condition like anything else. And it's not people's fault. It's arguably downstream from this same horrible food supply that we've been talking about. One of its many negative effects is it disrupts all the kind of neurotransmitter signaling or, you know, around food. And so those medications seem to really like strongly affect that part of the brain and just dampen down what they call, people describe as food noise. So they just finally get a break from this, like their brain just constantly knocking on the door, going like, give us some more food, give us some more food, give us some. Specifically that craving for carbohydrates seems to be that class of medication helped, which I'm supportive of the medications. You know, I think most people are, if as an option, because people need help. But for what it's worth, there are other ways to dampen down that food noise or perpetual craving for carbohydrates. And that is a little bit where the low-carb diet comes in, because what the research does really seem to show is one of the immediate effects of low-carb diet, even before it causes weight loss, is it can reduce or eliminate, in some cases, the just constant craving for carbohydrates. It just sort of erases that. So
that's good. That's good. That's good. Okay. Yeah. Another thing she said was she had never in her life felt full. Did you ever hear that?
Yeah.
What's that?
Yeah, well, that's the satiety. Again, so satiety means this ongoing feeling of, you know, having had enough to eat between meals. I mean, obviously, when it comes time to mealtime, it's normal to feel hungry. So no, expectation would never be to like never feel hungry. That would be weird. But like to be able to not think about food or not feel hungry between meals, that's satiety. A broken satiety mechanism, regulatory mechanism, is a key part of this metabolic dysfunction that I'm talking about in the book. That seems to be downstream from insulin resistance. So potentially insulin resistance or the problem with the mitochondria or the problem with the reward system, all these things we've been talking about, one of the main symptoms is this not being able to ever feel full. Yeah. So that what your friend described, that's a classic. I would say that's, you know, the majority of people who've been struggling, that's one of their main symptoms. And it's a really cruel symptom, because the messaging too, of course, is that, well, you should just eat less. But then their reality is like, that's painful, because like, because we're ultimately, Casey, like through my biology lens, we're animals, right? So you would never, it's quite cruel to think, oh, this poor animal has to like, just feel hungry all the time and never get to feel satisfied like that. And then just keep scolding them for, you know, wanting more food. That's kind of what the situation we've been in. I think that narrative, that traditional narrative of just eat less is a way that has created a lot of shame in people. And that's really sad. And that's actually one of the reasons I wrote the book, is just to say there is another way. It is possible to not feel hungry all the time. Like, and that's actually the first goal. That's the goal way before weight loss. If like step one is just to find a way to feel satisfied. In the book, I call them the signals of safety and satiety. So that's building a little bit on something that comes out of neuroscience, with the signals of safety that, you know, we send to our nervous system to tell it everything's okay. This would be like this, both you're okay and you've had enough to eat. And then now you can just, you know, do the things you love.
You said, and it was a partial sentence. You said, not think about food.
Yeah.
Just, you said it in the middle of a lot of other words.
Right.
but I saw it in like big black bold letters, and it looked like a foreign thing to me. Not think about food. Like, I can't even say it. I think about food constantly. And I think a lot of people do. And to all the healthy people, I just like to say, hey, I think about food all the time, as in how much can I eat? How healthy can I make it? When can I eat again? And how can I not get fat? Like, and I know I need to lose those 8 pounds, and I'm going to do that one day. Like, this is a swirling message, like in Times Square, you know, the words that go around Times Square, that's in my head. 24/7. What can I eat? When can I eat? How can I make it healthy? How can I not get fat? When am I going to lose 8 pounds?
Oh, I need to get a transcript of what you just said. I'll have to get the transcript from you later, because that's just it. You've just summarized it. I wish I could have put that in my book. That's the problem. That's a lot of people are in that situation. And trying to withstand that with willpower, as you said, like, what can I eat? How can I not get fat? How can I not eat? Like, what can I eat? And how can I not eat too much? Like, that's exhausting. Like, that there's no way. Remember, we talked about the people back in the 70s and like, they weren't thinking about that. You think all those people were actively like, just like managing to make all the right choices, like minute by minute of the day? Like, they were just like having their meal and then living their life. And then it's like, oh, and now it's time to eat again, and having their meal, and then just living their life. Like that's the goal, is that's the satiety. That's, yeah, having more energy, better insulin sensitivity. Exactly that. It is possible. I know it feels like, especially for maybe for you, like certainly for a lot of people, if you've been in that feeling for decades, potentially, it's hard to imagine not feeling like that, but it is possible.
Can't imagine it. Can't even imagine what it's like, a whole chunk of my life puzzle. So much is hijacking our health.
The regulatory mechanism of all this, the satiety regulatory mechanism, the sort of mitochondria's ability to like create energy and give all that energy to people to live their lives, that's been broken. That has been broken by the modern environment. Some aspects of it, definitely the food environment. This is why I wrote the book. This is such a common problem. And it's not just, obviously, these symptoms we've been talking about now, this like incessant food noise, the, you know, tendency to gain weight, especially around the middle, like potentially mood symptoms can be downstream from insulin resistance or metabolic dysfunction. And so can long-term risk of heart disease and other conditions. So this is why, from a medical perspective, definitely a lot of people are getting more and more concerned, because insulin resistance pretty much leads into directly, yeah, an increased risk of heart attack and stroke, just to give examples. So the stakes are high. Like, the stakes are high in terms of, it would be nice to get your life back and not, you know, feel hungry all the time. And also, yeah, it'd be nice to like live longer or be healthier and have a reduced risk of these things that, you know, are sort of the biggest reasons that cut our life short sometimes.
Laura Bryden, Metabolism Repair for Women, is the book, a compassionate, science-based guide to balancing insulin, losing weight, and
improving health.
Improving health. This has been so awesome. I love talking to you. Everybody's got to get the book. This is a great book. We got to read this book. We got to fix our bellies. I don't want to give us one more thing.
No.
You know what I mean? But this is a great place to
feel better. Yeah. Feel better, have more energy, naturally feel less hungry.
I'm going to ask you this. I know diet and exercise isn't the whole story, but how much do you exercise, my friend?
That's a very good question, because I am not a fitness buff. So I've been sharing a bit on my social media about this, just feeling it out there. I'm an avid walker. I'm from the mountains in Canada. Now I live near the mountains in New Zealand. So I do quite a bit of walking, but for me, it's about the being outside and the walking, and I do yoga. So those two. Now, the thing is, that's not going to be the right combination for everyone. Certainly there's, you know, evidence that strength training is important, and there's lots of theories out there and lots of science. But at the end of the day, I think we have to acknowledge that not everyone loves going to the gym. Not everyone's going to be a fitness buff for the years and years it takes to do this. So I think my message to people is just start with diet, actually. Start with some of the things we've been talking about here. Get some of your energy back, and then find a type of movement that is, you know, either enjoyable, hopefully, or at least, you know, the least painful kind of, you know, activity that you can do on a, you know, at least a couple times a week. So, yeah. I had someone else interview me that she, when I told her I didn't, you know, go to the gym, she almost fell off her chair. She was that shocked that I'd be talking about metabolic health and not recommending going to the gym. So, and again, those people back in the 70s, do you think they were all going to the gym?
No. Like, we didn't even have a gym in our community till like the 80s.
Yeah.
You know?
I know.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It was a roller rink.
Yeah.
And maybe that's telling. You know, because people were out living their lives and having fun.
Yeah, totally.
All right. I just followed you on Instagram.
Oh, good.
I'm happy to meet you.
Thrilled to meet you. Thanks so much, Casey.
Don't you love her? Lara Bryden. LaraBryden. Follow her everywhere. Her new book, Metabolism Repair for Women. I just love her. And you know what was so cool? She's in New Zealand. So I was talking to her on a Monday afternoon, but it was already Tuesday where she was. That was so cool. I never spoke to anybody in the future before. Hi, it's Casey. Thank you so much for tuning in to Shine On. Our thought for the day is from Dr. Ronald Hoffman, who said, "The gut is not like Las Vegas. What happens in the gut does not stay in the gut." I hope you and your gut have a wonderful week. For all that's going on, join me at caseysplace.com. Shine On.